The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Hey everybody, thanks so much for being here. This is my first talk at Socialism and I'm incredibly honored to be a part of it. So thanks so much for coming. So our planet has, since the beginning of its birth, gone through cycles of climate change. But this time is different. We've now experienced over 400 consecutive months with above average global temperatures, and the Arctic feels this warming most of all. The ice caps are melting, diminishing their ability to reflect much of the sun's heat back into space. Without the ability to reflect away the heat, more ice melts, and the cycle continues. If the current trend does not stop, there will be no ice at all in the Arctic Ocean before 2040. Despite its name, global warming is not just that. The warming trend causes destabilization of the Earth's atmosphere, leading to weather extremes of all sorts. We see more monsoons, tornadoes, and hurricanes with more extreme consequences than ever before. We have extreme high temperatures in some areas of the planet and extreme low temperatures in others. The world's delicate ecosystems and the species that rely on them are dying off at an alarming rate. We are now losing species at 1,000 to 10,000 times the background rate, with dozens of species going extinct every day. By the middle of the century, we may have lost 30 to 60% of all species on the planet. So, what are we going to do about it? To tackle this question, it's important to ask ourselves how we arrived at this point in the first place. So I'll begin with an anecdote from Clifford D. Connor's A People's History of Science. At the start of the 18th century, a serious energy crisis was afoot in England due to rapid deforestation attempting to overcome the fast rising demand for wood to build ships and make charcoal fuel. At the time, people were aware that coal was an alternate form of energy, but it couldn't be used to smelt iron in its natural state. In the early 1600s, the brewers of Derbyshire had been using coke as an alternative to charcoal to dry their malt for beer. It wasn't until the early 1700s, however, that coke was utilized outside of the brewing industry. An apprentice, Abraham Darby, was working for a company that manufactured malt grinding mills for making beer. During this process, he learned both metal casting techniques and brewer's craft. Darby began to experiment, and he was able to convert coal to coke and then use coke to successfully smelt iron. It was the work of an apprentice and the fusion of workers' technologies that enabled this to happen. Of course, once that knowledge was gained, the demand for coal rose, causing miners to dig even deeper in the earth to get it. But the deeper miners went, the more likely the mines were to be flooded. Now a new question arose. How could large quantities of water be raised from the mines? Again, it was not trained scientists or theoreticians that developed the pump required for such an endeavor, but rather it was a blacksmith, Thomas Newcomen, and a plumber, John Calley, who produced the first steam engine. Later improved by another craftsman, James Watt, the workhorse of the Industrial Revolution, the steam engine, enabled capitalist production to grow with unprecedented vigor. Steam-driven factories could be built anywhere and in great number. At last, capitalism was free to grow, seemingly unencumbered. And here we have the birth of the fossil fuel economy. Coal mines and now oil fields fuel the ability of the free market to continue to grow, all while pumping harmful emissions into the atmosphere and leading us to our current predicament. I tell this story not to blame these workers for global warming. Of course, these men did not know the consequences that their discoveries would have on the planet. Rather, I aim to make two points. First, the needs of society drive the development of technologies. And second, the development of these technologies most often arises from the workers themselves. So then, what are the needs of our capitalist society, and how can these needs be answered in a sustainable way? The media will tell you that capitalism can fix all of this mess. If allowed to flourish, the free market will naturally lead to more sustainable technologies. We, as consumers in this free market, can make conscious decisions of what to buy. We can eat locally, we can grow our own food, we can recycle. We can buy electric cars and secondhand clothes, and we should encourage everyone to do the same. There are bad companies out there, sure, but we can pressure them by only buying goods from exemplary corporate citizens. We can buy from companies that offset the production of their goods by planting trees in Africa, or donate 10% of the proceeds to environmental causes or research to cure diseases. Through our individual choices, we can promote energy-efficient technologies that will solve all of this mess. Our era, fondly termed by many as the age of individualism, is the era where our needs and goals as individuals are more important than anything else. As long as we make the right choices, nothing will get in our way. The reality is, though, that our individual needs mean nothing to capitalist society. There is one need and one need only: grow or die. As Umair Muhammad so aptly stated in his book, Confronting Injustice, the age of individualism is also the age of conformity. Mass production, if it is to be sustained, must be accompanied by mass consumption, and therein lies the source of our conformity. Our identities as family members, friends, students, workers, and citizens have come to be subordinated by consumerism. Turning on the TV, we may come across a commercial featuring a sleek silver sedan zooming around a glorious, unpolluted mountain road. This vehicle, run on electric batteries, will drastically reduce our carbon footprint, and we'll look sexy as hell doing it. But why is it that our society favors the car as its primary mode of transportation? Surely public transportation is less polluting, and walkable living environments are healthier and cheaper for both individual travelers and government budgets as a whole. Nonetheless, public policies continue to incentivize the use of cars over other forms of travel. Our dependence on cars exists because of corporate power. The media very carefully and very consistently tells us what our needs are every day. Our major news sources are concentrated in their ownership, and nearly only five major conglomerates own almost all of our mainstream news sources. This news is sourced from White House correspondents, promoting a reliance on government and corporate sources, and making the media unwilling to challenge the stories provided to them. To top it all off, the media relies on advertising for revenue, again promoting a greater reliance on corporate interests. Advertising wastes energy in itself, divests from important areas, and promotes investments and homogenizes human need into the consumerist and destructive nature of capitalism. By advertising green technologies to quell the guilt of the consumer, the media masks the inherent mismatch between planetary survival and consumerism as a whole. In order to continue manufacturing products and accumulating capital, businesses require constant access to energy. And while we would like to think that scientific research and development is dedicating to finding new renewable sources of energy, instead we see that the US government has devoted its research and development funds to protect and defend its existing sources of energy, oil. This deep connection between climate chaos, militarism, and war stands out particularly in the Middle East, where armies of American soldiers and drones are stationed to guard pipelines for petroleum companies. Thinly veiled under xenophobic rhetoric, the war on terror, the US military is an oppressive imperialist force, pumping dangerous toxins into the environment, brutally repressing resistance, and consuming colossal quantities of oil to power its war machine. No, the government is not invested in finding new energy sources. In fact, breaking away from the use of oil threatens everything about the capitalist way of life. I know this all sounds incredibly bleak, and to be quite frank, it is. But not all hope is lost. As the world's resources continue to be depleted, as forests are torn down, as pipelines are drilled, more people are beginning to say enough is enough. As the climate crisis continues to grow, so do social movements with an ecological dimension. Urban workers, indigenous communities, and people of the global south are standing up, fighting against environmental injustice. It is men and women who dig coal, who build cars, and run electricity plants. Only mass action can lead to change that we wish to see, no, that we need to see, if humankind is to survive after capitalism inevitably falls. Consistently in the environmental justice movement and social justice movements everywhere, the people least responsible for the problems of climate change are the same people who are faced with the worst of its consequences. In the United States, it is indigenous communities and people of color who are most likely to breathe polluted air or drink contaminated water, who are most vulnerable during severe storms. Environmental threats will continue to expand the gap between the rich and poor and will continue to exacerbate already existing inequalities. We see this exacerbation particularly clearly in Puerto Rico after hurricanes Irma and Maria have devastated the island, wiping out electricity, water, and food for months. The aid has been utterly devoid of urgency, and many Puerto Ricans have died from preventable causes or relocated entirely. The devastation runs much deeper than these recent storms, however, which have served to unmask the effects of a 130-year-old colonial relationship with the U.S. government that minimizes the lives of Puerto Rican people. We now see disaster capitalists sweeping in, aiming to transform Puerto Rico into a privatized utopia. And Governor Roselló has met with bankers, real estate developers, cryptocurrency traders, and the Financial Oversight and Management Board to capitalize on the blank canvas produced by Maria. The storm's devastations have revealed many things about the systems that do not work. Puerto Rico's extreme dependence on imported fuel and food, the dangers of the highly centralized food system, and the continually privatized school systems. The people of Puerto Rico, however, have been awakened to a bitter truth. No government holds their interests at heart. Not their governor, not the unelected fiscal control board, and certainly not Washington, D.C. And if Maria has truly offered an opportunity to build a new Puerto Rico, the Puerto Ricans themselves must be the ones to dream it up and fight for it from the bottom to the top. Maria, referred to as our teacher by activists across the island, has forced communities to organize themselves on a remarkable scale. Communities have set up massive communal kitchens and hubs with solar power and traditional farming practices, raised large sums of money, distributed supplies, cleared streets, and rebuilt schools. Through the devastation, communities are beginning to discover a resilience and capacity that they did not previously recognize. A coalition is beginning to form called Junta Gente, or the People Together, representing groups from around the island who are using their knowledge and organizational tools to envision a radically transformed Puerto Rico. Organizations such as Organización Boricua, who highlight the value of traditional farming practices to overcome the reliance on imported food, Casa Pueblo and Coqui Solar, pushing for rapid and locally controlled transition to solar power, and the Federation of Puerto Rican Teachers, who've organized to keep their schools open. The story is incredibly rich, and I don't have time to go into the details during this talk, but I encourage all of you to read Naomi Klein's new book, The Battle for Paradise, for which 100% of the proceeds go to build the Junta Gente movement. There are also several other talks at this conference on the topic, where you can learn more about the struggles in Puerto Rico today. On every continent across the planet, there's an increasing frequency of intense resistance movements against various forms of environmental injustice. As I was researching material for this talk, I came across the Environmental Justice Atlas, which is an incredible resource that documents the many acts of resistance going on across the globe. I highly recommend noting this website, ejatlas.org, to learn more about these movements, to find local actions, and to build international solidarity. Many of the conflicts around the world have arisen due to the process of land grabbing, in which large corporate-owned plantations take over large swaths of land for unsustainable monoculture. These plantations replace food crops with palm oil, deprive farmers from their land, deforest huge areas, pollute water, threaten biodiversity, and deplete the soil of nutrients. Grassroots organizations comprised of indigenous populations, farmers, landless peasants, religious groups, have in over 600 areas around the world begun to fight back. In Honduras, Colombia, Mexico, Indonesia, and Myanmar, these networks have been able to temporarily suspend the expansion of these plantations and take back the land. These movements are often met with brutal repression of resistance, violent arrests, and even murder of activists. But we will not forget, and we will not back down. Many global conflicts are arising due to the formation, ironically, of renewable energy sources. Mega dams are being produced in India, the Amazon basin, the Balkans, and Africa. Mega wind projects have started in Mexico, Kenya, and India. Under corporate control, these technologies that could have been developed sustainably to reduce our ecological footprint have led instead to the production of unjust and large-scale projects that lead to flooding of local farmland, polluting of drinking water, and the spreading of infectious diseases. Again, local communities are standing up, blocking construction, taking to the streets, and going on strike. Groups comprised of indigenous populations, fisher people, local scientists, and concerned community members all across the world. Having depleted much of the easily accessible supply of the world's fossil fuels, the fossil fuel industries are relying more and more on unconventional technologies and locations of extraction. The fossil fuel industry is now extending its hand into oil sand drilling, fracking, to Arctic drilling and deep water petroleum sources. These processes are incredibly dangerous, leading to major pollution of water supplies, devastation of marine habitats, unpredictable seismic activity, and of course, global warming. Massive movements across the globe have culminated into the Blockadian movement, which aims to connect struggles and to highlight global threats posed by fossil fuel extraction. The Blockadian movement originated from movements such as the Yasuni Initiative in Ecuador to leave the oil in the soil, and the Ogoni people against Shell in the Niger Delta in the 1990s, and has now expanded to diverse resistance, including Ende Gelände in Germany, the indigenous-led Standing Rock Camp against the Dakota Access Pipeline, and the movement in Kenya to decolonize. These various movements involve people defending their land, livelihoods, and climate from fossil fuel projects through diverse direct actions, including street protests and blockades. The Blockadia map is still growing and represents a space for movement building and international solidarity, a tool for building stronger movement against the various injustices we currently face. Just as the environment itself is interconnected, so too is the environmental justice movement. The people, the causes, the resistance are all inextricably linked. I could go on and on for many more hours about all of the inspiring movements taking place across the globe, led by women, indigenous communities, people of color, by workers. There are endless injustices to fight against. These case studies show how successful these movements can be and should serve as inspiration. When we, the ordinary people of the world, organize ourselves into networks and struggle for the kind of world we want to see, when we express grievances and make political demands, we can build a better and more sustainable world. To keep global temperatures from rising to catastrophic levels, we need an 80% reduction in global greenhouse gas emissions by 2050. To do this, we must fight for concrete and urgent reforms. We need a drastic and enforceable reduction in greenhouse gas emission. We need to devote resources to develop clean energy sources and progressively replace cars and trucks with trains and an extensive and free public transportation system. We need aggressive pollution cleanup programs, and we need to eliminate war spending. Through fighting for these reforms, workers around the world will begin to see that the system is rigged. These urgent demands can lead us to a process of radicalization. As we win small victories, we will recognize how many more victories we need. Each reform leads to a new demand, a more radical aim. Partial reforms will not do the trick, and the reforms we need are directly opposed to the competitive drive of our capitalist society. In order to achieve these reforms, we require a drastic change in our very societal structure. Capitalism cannot tolerate limits on growth, but this endless expansion is fully incompatible with the long-term stability of the planet. The needs of society must be shifted, but in order to achieve this, society must be able to collectively define its goals and collectively own the means of production. Instead of unlimited growth based on endless accumulation of profit, we require a democratically controlled system of production in which products and technologies are produced according to the real social needs and the protection of the environment. The Industrial Revolution was enabled by machines, but the revolution we require now is a social one. Only when we radically transform the nature of our society will the technology we produce be for us, for our planet, not one commodified down to its profitable parts. Ultimately, technology drives science, and currently, capitalist needs drive the formation of technology. As long as the needs of society are based on profit and capital, the technologies that we use and produce will not be optimized. In fact, the technologies we use and produce today are almost always oppressive and contribute directly to the climate crisis. Developing technologies that will address the climate crisis will only be possible with an eco-socialist revolution. And this revolution will be international and universal, or it will be nothing. We have seen incredible things happen when workers begin to recognize their ability to change the world around them. The brewers of Derbyshire and an iron worker, unknowingly planting the seeds for an industrial revolution. The seeds for our revolution are already being planted, and now it is time to nurture those seeds. So, comrades, let's remember, the single most powerful thing that we can do for climate justice is to practice active solidarity. This conference is an active site of the struggle. It is here that we make connections, where we plug in and build a global movement. So yes, make individual choices. Divest from big banks that fund oil pipelines. Buy books like Naomi Klein's The Battle for Paradise that benefit communities directly fighting against environmental injustice. Take part in promoting reforms that minimize pollution and develop green architecture. Bring people into the struggle with you. Support local communities defending their lands. Take to the streets, block the pipelines, organize in your workplace, and shut the whole thing down. When we come together in acts of defiance, our struggles become part of a bigger movement, and we can build a better world.
Hey, good morning, comrades. I'm happy to report, for any of you who didn't see the news yesterday, that Scott Pruitt, the climate change denying head of the Environmental Protection Agency, has collapsed under the weight of his own corruption. Trump accepted his resignation yesterday. He was under investigation 13 times over for misuse of federal funds, which makes sense since his only qualifications for running the EPA were a series of lawsuits against the agency. Since he cited the constant attacks he was facing as his reason for resigning, I have to believe that the mother who confronted him about the climate crisis last week with her child on her hip while he was out to lunch was the final straw for him. Okay, so can technology solve the climate crisis? There are a lot of commentators out there saying yes. All we need is a technical breakthrough, and don't worry, some of the greatest innovators and disruptors are at it. Elon Musk is the techno savior we need, at least according to Rolling Stone. His launching a Tesla into space will inspire innovators everywhere, just what we need to break through climate pessimism. The Breakthrough Energy Coalition, which numbers among its members Jeff Bezos from Amazon, Jack Ma from the Alibaba Group, and Richard Branson, have committed to investing more than $1 billion in new technologies over the next 20 years. Just to drop in the bucket for them. Other commentators say we already have plenty of technology. Not only do we have solar, wind, efficient battery technology, but also electric cars, meat grown in a lab, carbon capture, biofuels. If all else fails, we can put giant mirrors in space, dump iron into the oceans, inject sulfate particles into the atmosphere. The only missing piece, they bemoan, is political will. They say we need a psychological and moral breakthrough, not a technological one. Others say we just need to give the market time. Renewable resources can be profitable, and we need to just let the market warm up to them. But even with government investment after the financial crisis, renewables still account for less than 10% of energy consumption, while fossil fuels still make up 80%. Fossil fuels remain the most profitable, and we need to move much faster. Others say we just need to internalize into the market things that have been externalized by putting a price on waste and environmental damage in order to penalize energy companies and reduce the profitability of fossil fuels to give renewables a chance to compete. This idea comes in the form of cap and trade and carbon trading schemes. It hasn't worked. Big polluters have financial incentive to game the system, and they always find a way. The best examples of this fall pathetically far behind the necessary reductions to slow down climate change. And whatever waste the governments are willing to make corporations pay for, it can't substantially interfere with profitability or growth, or it will screw with the whole economy. So they're not going to do that. So what do Marxists say? Can technology solve the climate crisis? First, we need to be clear what we mean by solve. As Chris Williams puts it, even were we to stop emitting greenhouse gases today, industrialized human civilization based on the burning of fossil fuels for energy has set in motion changes to the earth that are essentially irreversible and can only be measured on timescales which are difficult to comprehend. We're already living through the sixth mass extinction. No one really knows what the impact of ocean acidification will be. And people are already experiencing the effects of climate change around the world, with storms with increasing frequency and intensity, wildfires as a consequence of drought, etc. So can technology avert the worst case scenario for climate catastrophe? Yes, potentially, and no, not on its own. We do have the technology that we would need to stop burning fossil fuels and contributing to global warming, which is a key piece of the climate crisis. But what we need is more than a psychological breakthrough to get that technology implemented on the scale and on the timeline we need to hopefully prevent the planet from becoming uninhabitable. We need a social movement to force reforms and ultimately a revolution to reorder society in order to meet people's needs rather than generate profit. We've known for many decades that climate change is a real problem, that it has been caused by human activity, that it's causing irreparable damage to the planet and all of its inhabitants, including humans, and that we need to stop burning fossil fuels immediately as the key first step towards stopping our contribution to the problem. We've also had the technology for decades to generate fuel from renewable resources, and those technologies like solar panels and battery storage have continued to become more and more efficient. Most people in the US think that climate change is a problem. 3/4 of think that we should invest in renewable energy sources rather than fossil fuels. Even 43% of Republicans think the government needs to do something about climate change. So if we lived in a democracy, or if it were enough to just have the information and the technology, then the US government and governments around the world would already be doing something substantial to solve the climate crisis. And yet, last year, fossil fuel corporations spent $675 billion scouring the earth for new deposits of coal, oil, and gas. Even more backwards, Trump thinks that climate change is a hoax, that the polar ice caps are at record levels, and he wants to withdraw the US from the Paris Climate Accords, which are toothless enough as it is. But it's not just Trump. The leaders of both political parties remain committed to seeing the profits of US oil and energy companies grow. Obama led a massive expansion of fracking for natural gas and other extreme energy extraction, opening the East Coast and the Arctic to deeper offshore drilling as part of his all of the above strategy for US energy independence. And other governments are no better. The G20 members are spending $450 billion a year subsidizing fossil fuel production, despite pledging to phase out fossil fuel support to tackle climate change. The fact is, as long as burning fossil fuels remains profitable, the global ruling class and their respective states are not going to do anything to seriously stop climate change unless we force their hands. The barrier to changing things on the scale necessary to avert the climate crisis is capitalism. Even the New York Times published an opinion piece declaring capitalism is at the heart of the climate crisis. The defining features of capitalism are that capitalism concentrates the means of production in relatively few hands. Most people have to exchange their labor for a wage. Capitalists retain the products of that labor and must bring them to sale in markets to realize profits. Capitalism produces commodities, which are goods and services for sale rather than for use. There's a monetary system, including bank credit, and production is primarily motivated by profit. And without that expectation of profit, production won't happen. Profit is added from a combination of labor, technology, and raw materials. There can be no opting out of profit. If one capitalist does, they will swiftly be replaced. And there's never enough profit, production, or growth. These must always be increasing under capitalism. Capitalists must constantly exploit humans and the environment and do it better than their competitors. Each state protects its own corporation's profit-making abilities on the global stage through imperialism, and each corporation makes rational decisions based on their own short-term profits. But the anarchy of the market means there's no mechanism for longer-term planning for the collective benefit of all. The environment, under the logic of capitalism, is nothing more than a source and a sink. The cost of removing raw materials from the earth or adding waste, including pollution and emissions, are not taken into account. These are externalities. Engels puts it, as long as the individual manufacturer or merchant sells a manufactured or purchased commodity with the usual coveted profit, he is satisfied and does not concern himself with what afterwards becomes of the commodity or its purchasers. The same thing applies to the natural effects of the same actions. What cared the Spanish planters in Cuba who burned down forests on the slopes of the mountains and obtained from the ashes sufficient fertilizer for one generation of highly profitable coffee trees? What cared they that the tropical rain afterward washed away the unprotected upper stratum of the soil, leaving behind only bare rock? In relation to nature, as to society, the present mode of production is predominantly concerned only about the immediate, most tangible result. That unfettered growth and accumulation that is capitalism is diametrically opposed to sustainability on a finite planet. As Marx puts it, talking specifically about capitalist agriculture, all progress is the art not only of robbing the workers, but of robbing the soil. All progress in increasing the fertility of the soil for a given time is progress towards ruining the more long-lasting sources of fertility. Capitalist production, therefore, only develops the techniques and the degree of combination of the social process of production by simultaneously undermining the original sources of all wealth, the soil and the workers. Marx's analysis of capitalism can help to counter the belief that market mechanisms could ever promote a healthy relationship between humans and the environment. He shows how the disruption of the human relationship with nature is an integral feature of capitalism. So we need more than technical fixes to build a society that's in harmony with and a part of nature. We also need an internationally coordinated reordering of production and distribution, which the current ruling class is utterly incapable of. There comes a point when the social relations become a fetter on the further development of the productive forces, but this contradiction also creates a potential for change by creating the working class that has the potential power to both stop the current system of production and restart and reorganize a different system of production, since we do all the producing. So we need to get rid of capitalism, but how do we get there from here? We need to build every struggle for reforms to build up the kind of movement it will take in order to do what we can to stop any piece of the climate disaster as soon as possible, and to build up the kind of movement that it will take to win a democratic revolution that actively involves the vast majority of society. We know that ecological and social issues are inextricably intertwined, and capitalism is at the heart of all of them. This means that our fightbacks are also intertwined. We can find hope in the fight back against Trump's immigration policies. We know that climate change, as well as imperialism in the service of corporate interests and over control of fossil fuels, are drivers of migration, and fighting for the rights of people to cross borders will be an essential demand for any movement for ecological justice. When teachers go on strike against cuts to education funding and demand that energy companies pay their fair share, we can say that's our fight too. We can see the potential for the kind of social and political struggle that we need to win reforms now and to, down the road, a revolution and a restructuring of society to provide for everyone's needs. In terms of doing something immediate about the climate crisis, what demands can we fight for and potentially win now? One concrete demand would be shifting the priorities of government subsidies from fossil fuels to renewables. Globally, governments give away $550 billion per year to fossil fuel companies as subsidies, which is four times the amount spent on incentives for renewables, and we should demand that governments shift that money away from fossil fuels to invest in renewable energy infrastructure and job training for the people who currently work in coal, oil, and fracking to transition to solar, wind, etc. We can demand tighter government regulation in terms of emissions and pollution, retrofitting houses and buildings to run on electric heat, better free public transportation that runs on electricity generated through renewable energy sources, and we can demand improvements to energy efficiency in homes and in industry, which could really drastically reduce our energy use. And we should demand taxing the rich and the energy corporations to pay for it. We need to reject the notion of shared sacrifice and the notion that the problem is the number of people on the planet. It's entirely possible to enhance the standards of living for most people while cutting emissions. The richest 7% are responsible for half of emissions, while the poorest 50% are responsible for only 7% of emissions. Nuclear energy should not be among our demands. It's not only expensive, it's dangerous. Accidents are a regular occurrence. Radioactive waste has to be stored for 10,000 years. The mining and refining the necessary uranium is a highly pollution and energy intensive process that leaves behind radioactive tailings that pollute the surrounding water and cause birth defects and reproductive problems for people who live nearby. It's possible to win reforms even under Trump. The only way our side has ever won anything is by movements in the street that force the hands of those in power. In the 60s and 70s, the civil rights movement in the US inspired a whole host of other social movements for change, including the environmental movement. Nixon was not a progressive by any measure, but the social movement forced his hand into passing the most effective environmental legislation to date. After a 20 million strong protest against the rights of corporations to pollute, he was forced to pass the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act, and create the Environmental Protection Agency. The fight for reforms in here and now is important, but ultimately we need globally coordinated change on a timescale only possible if we remove the profit motive and change who's in charge of making the decisions. We need a revolution by the working class, a complete reordering of production led by the producers. We need actual democracy and planning on a global scale, and profit can no longer be the guiding principle, but rather meeting the needs of all humans and of the ecosystem that we live in. The right to privately own the land and means of production must be abolished. Only by holding the land and the means of production in common and producing to meet social need will the simultaneous exploitation of nature and humanity end. If we, the working class, are able to win a revolution and take power from the hands of the capitalists in order to run society democratically, what are some of the changes that we could make? None of this is a blueprint, just a starting point for discussion, but we could immediately stop the production of many unnecessary goods, such as weapons, all military technology, some large portion of the 70 million cars produced each year. We could retrofit many factories to use energy more efficiently to produce more durable and long-lasting goods. We could end single-use plastics and packaging designed for advertising. Most people having access to more goods would not necessarily mean more resource throughput. There's no technical barrier to transitioning over a period of 20 to 30 years to entirely carbon-free energy generation. A combination of solar, wind, tidal, and geothermal energy generation, based on what makes sense for each region of the world, could easily generate enough energy for all of our needs. Solar panels over 0.5% of the Sahara Desert, for example, could provide enough electricity for the whole continent. Offshore wind farms could provide enough for all of the European Union's electricity needs. Geothermal energy available in the US with currently available technology, energy that's easily extractable and minimal environmental impacts or emissions represents 2,000 times the current primary energy use of the US. And we could change the way that we get around. Electric trains, light rail, and trams, public transportation instead of each individual having their own car. We could drastically reduce the need for air travel with high-speed trains and plenty of time off. We could change the way that we produce food, eliminate all the petrochemicals that we contaminate the land with, artificial fertilizers, pesticides, etc. Put the animals near the plants so that you can use their manure to fertilize. Switch from monoculture to sustainable small-scale agriculture, which studies actually show could feed everyone more efficiently than the current monoculture industrial agriculture. So Marx wrote extensively about the need to heal the metabolic rift created by capitalism, which separates humans from their environment. Humans are a part of nature which has been cut off from itself. At the dawn of capitalism, people were forced off the land and into cities to work in factories. Under socialism, we could reconsider how population centers are organized and spread out, organize them not around profit, but around producing what we need to survive. Much of this could happen on a more localized level than it does now, which would result in the population spreading out rather than being concentrated in huge metropolises. Rosa Luxemburg was talking about the horrors of war, but it's equally applicable to the climate crisis to say bourgeois society stands at the crossroads. Either transition to socialism or regression into barbarism. We know disaster is possible, but we refuse to surrender to despair. If we fight, we may lose. If we don't fight, we'll definitely lose. And a conscious collective struggle to stop the disaster of capitalism is our only hope for a better world. So can technology solve the climate crisis? not on its own. It matters what we do. The working class has the potential to liberate all of humanity. We need to organize and fight for the realization of that potential. Only then can we collectively interact with nature according to a conscious plan, using the knowledge and technology that we already possess to organize production and distribution on a completely new footing that is both in harmony with and a part of nature.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.